Hello there.
You listening to Trek FM?
Want to join in the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners' discussion group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field, and we'll look forward to seeing you there.
This is Steve Sansweet of Rancho Obi-Wan, and you're listening to the 602 Club.
Hello and welcome to the 602 Club, TFM's local watering hole, coming at you from the Parthenon. It is really nice in here. They have done a good job, and I'm excited because we are going to talk about one of the biggest movies of the year. And so I'm just one of your hosts, Matthew Rushing. And of course, with me as he is, I'm so excited for this. Almost every single episode these days is none other than General Rye Paulson. General, it's so great to have you back from the war in Troy. It's been about 10 years.
Yeah, it's been quite a time. The journey home was no short of surprises. So happy to be here. Happy to talk about, the arguably one of the biggest movies this year. Should be fun.
I think it's undeniable that this is the biggest movie that's come out so far this year. Mm-hmm. I mean, of all the movies that we've had, I don't think there's been a bigger film or one that people are kind of anticipating more than, you know, Chris Nolan's look at The Odyssey. So that's what we're going to dive into. Of course, you could find us all over the place on social media. We would love to interact with you. We're over on X, Twitter, at the 602 Club, Instagram, at the 602 Club TFM. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. You can find us online at our new website at tfm.fan. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and that way you'll get all the episodes as soon as they come out. And you know, give a star rating, reviews, help people find the show. And if you like the show, just share it with a friend. You know, really, honestly, the best way that podcasts grow is people just saying, hey, you should listen to this. So if you like our show, please do that for us. We'd really appreciate that. So before we kind of like dive into the movie or anything like that, I was kind of wondering how you were coming into this with knowing that it's Nolan. And of course, you know, this is based off a 3,000-year-old story that most of us have to read at least in high school once. And so, where were you with this? Like, you know, not only with Nolan, but also just your familiarity with the story of The Odyssey in the first place?
Yeah, I mean, coming in, Nolan is arguably one of my favorite directors. He's definitely up there as my favorite current working directors. I love a lot of his movies. I mean, we'll do, I think, a ranking here at the end, and you'll see that my like lowest rated movie is still positive. So I love Nolan. I think I'm excited for any time he makes a movie. The last, like, I think, I want to say 8 years, 9 years of his career have been very exciting. Each movie I've been more and more excited for as they've been coming out. It was a big deal when Oppenheimer came out. And then this has just been, I mean, I remember after Oppenheimer, what's he going to do next? What could he do that's bigger, that's grander, that's whatever? And when he said The Odyssey, like, wow. Yeah. That's apart from like the Bible, it's one of the most known stories in humanity's history. So, it was like, wow, this could be cool. This could be epic, obviously, in a lot of senses. And then, I've read The Odyssey, read it in high school, some of it probably, read it in college. Not like a fan. I don't know if some people are like, some people are probably big fans of The Odyssey. Very cool. Incredible story passed down through generations, but didn't have like any attachment to it, I'd say. And so coming into it, I was like excited to see what Nolan was going to do, and excited to get his take on it, and was mostly excited just for his like all this technical stuff behind the scenes, shooting on an IMAX camera the whole time, like all that fun stuff, getting tickets to IMAX theaters, like all that is what excites me about a new Nolan film. But what about you?
Yeah, I mean, look, I don't think that it would surprise anybody to know that Christopher Nolan is one of my favorite directors these days. And a big part of that is that he is doing things that nobody else does, right? I mean, he is making movies that nobody else even thinks of to make. And like you, as we go through my rankings at the end of Christopher Nolan, even what's at the bottom, right, of the list is still above average as a film.
Yeah.
Right. And so that's an incredible track record for a director to have. And, you know, I would say, too, in the last like 10 years or more, you know, his run of films is just ridiculous. And so I think that is, you know, something that regardless of how I feel about this movie or anything else, like that's just a crazy, that's a crazy achievement. Right. And so, you know, and I think the other thing, like you said, you know, next to the Bible, nothing has set Western civilization like Homer, right? I mean, you know, when it comes to what has created what we know as Western civilization, I mean, Homer is it, other than Christianity and the Bible. And so, you know, that I think puts a lot of weight on his shoulders. And again, you know, I think that's something that's going to be a really interesting discussion throughout this, because I'm more on the side of coming from this is that let's bring to life a story that, you know, everybody knows and everybody's read in a way that honors that story. And so that I think this is going to be a really interesting conversation for us. And so I wanted to ask you about this because one of the – I mean the tagline for the movie, even on the poster, right, is Defy the Gods.
Right.
And as presented in the film – that's what Odysseus seems to want. He wants to be able to control his own world. And so already in that, I would say that that is very different from the Odysseus of the story as presented in Homer. And so I wanted to ask you about that because it does seem very strange to me, because then there's this whole other side to the story where on one side, Odysseus wants to defy the gods. But on the other side, he spends the entire movie being sad sack Odysseus because he defied Zeus's law, which seems very strange to me that you would have this character who apparently wants to defy the gods, yet at the same time feels this incredible weight of having defied this law, known as Zeus's law, which is traditionally known as Xenia, which is it's the idea of you know, maintaining that hosts treat their guests with respect and care because they could be a god in disguise. Whereas Nolan basically takes that and turns it into the golden rule in his story and his interpretation, which is do unto others. And so I wanted to ask you about this because it feels like there's a real tension just in the movie and in the characterization of the character itself. And how did that work for you?
Yeah, I don't think I had an issue with it. I think that there is the tension of like Odysseus, he wants to defy the gods, he wants to get home. Like, I mean, he has that line where whoever he was talking, I think it was Calypso he was talking to, where it was like all your, whoever it was, all your men are gonna die, you know, that's what the gods say. He's like, then I'll defy the gods. And I don't even think that, because yeah, it seems like a contradiction that he wants to defy the gods, but at the same time, he's this whole movie, the way Nolan interprets it and themes it and changes kind of the messaging a little bit too, is he is living with this like weight of his own decisions, his trickery that, you know, caused the fall of Troy and them winning the war there. And obviously we get things later in the movie and like the very end of the movie that kind of encapsulate why he's feeling such grief, such kind of heartache over his own sin almost. And so I viewed it more as like that, where he is, he wants to defy the gods because he's also this inconsistent character, I think, where he wants to defy the gods, but also he realizes that whether true or not, Zeus's law, what he has done has led to the destruction of not just Troy, but created this, to use Oppenheimer language, like this chain reaction in the world. That, like, he is the sea people, you know, as they're talking about. And so I found it interesting. I like it. It's always hard with adaptations. We talked about Supergirl, where I hated the way they adapted it. I thought it was terrible. And I think I joked with you that I told my buddy that I'm a hypocrite. I pick and choose. You know, I like things that don't, that are faithful adaptations. And I'm like, or when it's not faithful, I'm like, this is stupid. Like, if no one adapted the Bible, I'd be a pretty big stickler on it. You know, so, but yeah, I liked the change. I valued it. I thought it was, a natural progression from Oppenheimer for Nolan. And it caused me to think quite a bit about just humanity and what I think he was going for in particular.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the interesting aspects of this is the fact that this idea of defy the gods, you know, Odysseus in the story, there are certain gods to which he kind of does want to defy, right? Mm-hmm. Specifically Poseidon, because, you know, Poseidon is the person and the god who is against him the most in the story, mm-hmm. because of, you know, what he does to the Cyclops.
Yep.
And, you know, that we'll talk all about Odysseus's character specifically, mm-hmm. But I think that you're absolutely right in the sense that this movie, in its thematic element of like changing this idea of like Zeus's law to basically be more like the golden rule, mm-hmm. and then what it does to Odysseus as a character and how he feels about it, there is this very strange, I would say, I mean, I don't even know where we are. We're not in the postmodern era. Whatever era we're in at this point, it feels the most today that it could, in the sense that these opposing elements that Odysseus holds within himself in his character that are so inconsistent feels very much of today, that people can hold these views that are completely opposed to one another, and yet they see no issue with the inconsistency in themselves. And I feel like that is very much what we get in the film, especially with the character. And it's interesting because, to me, a part of this is the way that it kind of resolves itself in the film, right? Like, the movie ends with this whole idea that humanity will continually build up civilization and then tear it down.
Mm-hmm.
And what I was left with in the film, and I wanted to know how you thought about this, because this whole idea of like defying Zeus's law, which creates this whole idea of, you know, basically destroying civilization from the inside out. The movie very much seemed to say to me that, hey, learn from this, right? Mm-hmm. But the problem is that as it's telling us this from a 3,000-year-old perspective, you're just going to keep doing this. And in the end, the saddest part of the movie was that it has no answer, and that in the end, all you get is nihilism. Like, I would contend that this might be the most nihilistic movie I've ever seen, because there's no answer that Nolan has. And what's interesting is that it's almost like he wants to say, but he can't because he's such a materialist, that we've all defied God's law and we're paying for it. But he won't say that at the end of the movie, and he won't leave you with that because he can't. That's just not within his belief system to do. And so in the end, the answer is we're never actually going to overcome our sinful state, because there is no answer to this other than just be nice to people. And well, we've already seen that if that was happening 3,000 years ago and we look at history, well, we're just doomed to repeat it because we've never changed as humanity. We may have pretended like we've gotten more civilized, but we really haven't in many ways. And I think that might have been the thing where I'm going to land on this movie comes down to this feeling I was feeling the whole movie, which is like, wow, this is hopeless and helpless, and there's nothing about this story that gives me any hope. And man, I came out of this movie like kind of super depressed. And I wanted to know how you felt about that, because that aspect of who Odysseus is and what he's wrestling with and where we leave it at the end of the film, it's like, man, bro just literally leaves at the end of the movie. Mm-hmm. Like, he's like, peace out, good luck, Telemachus, you know, because like I'm just peacing out.
Yeah, for him peacing out, I viewed it as him atoning for his sin, right? Self-exile. It's why Telemachus couldn't kill, even though he does, which is funny, but no one knows, apparently. I found the ending not the most hopeful in any sense. I found the ending just as, like, I'm fascinated that you like Oppenheimer but don't like this. I think this, if we're considering movies nihilistic, I think Oppenheimer's just as nihilistic. Like, the movie ends with, like, you remember when I said I think this would start a chain reaction, it would destroy the whole world, and Einstein's like, yeah, I recall it, and he's like, I think we did, which I think is just as, like, nihilistic in nature. I don't view it as nihilistic in the sense that, like, I think the movie's point is trying to begin the conversation. Like, the movie's not telling us the that there's hope, but like the view of how terrible things can be is the, at least that's how I'm taking it, is then the hope. I think that there's some elements of hope within Odysseus's story at the end, as he's leaving, he's passing on the throne to Telemachus, he's going to bury his men with honor. I think there's elements of hope. I understand not viewing it completely like that, but with a movie like this where it does end with, like, history repeats itself, we've broken God's law, and because of that, like, the sea people spread, the brokenness of the world spreads, the evilness spreads, and I don't expect Nolan to have the answer to that. I am happy that it's noticed and that it's put on display, because there's something intrinsically Christian about that idea that there is something wrong. Like, the line in the movie is to burn the walls of Troy is to, or destroy the walls of Troy is to destroy the whole world, which is true. Like, once God's law has been broken, everything after that is continuing to be broken. There's only one answer, and I don't expect Nolan to have that answer. There's inklings of an answer he's trying to get at, but he doesn't know. Obviously, because I don't think Nolan's a Christian. And wouldn't that be a crazy twist if he is, like, turned to Jesus? That'd be crazy. But I think that that's where I'm at with stories like this, where there's an absence of a direct, like, Superman. Like, there's a very apparent, like, the character give in the 2025 movie gives this, like, here's the hope for the world notion. And I think that's great, but I think the absence of it as well also leads to well, there needs to be an answer somehow. There needs to be something. And Nolan doesn't quite understand it, but I don't dock him for not knowing that personally. I understand, like, your point of view. You're like, this is nihilistic. I don't enjoy this. Like, that makes sense. I think that's totally fine. And I've talked to some people that feel the same way. But I've also talked to people that feel the same way I do. They're like, the movie's not inherently hopeful. There's bits and pieces. But in the absence of hope in the movie, it begs the question, where is the hope actually found? That's kind of how I viewed it. That's how I left the theater. I mean, I've seen this movie 3 times now. I went at 7 a.m. on Tuesday morning. Like, that's how much I've been enjoying this movie.
That's impressive.
Yeah. On Monday night, I was telling my wife, I was like, they're just showing at 7 a.m. tomorrow. I was like, do you care? She's like, I don't give a crap. If you want to get up that early and go to the movie, do what you want. But it was funny. But yeah, so that's kind of how I was leaning towards it. Right. I understand your point of view. I just didn't feel that personally.
Yeah. No, I think I'm not coming across this expecting Nolan to have the answers, but totally. I think it's important for us to jump into why I feel like this is such a problem, which is the fact that we completely and irrevocably changed Odysseus's character.
Yeah. I mean, my hot take is I think it's better. Like, I don't like this. I like the story of the Odyssey. I think Odysseus is a great character in the book or the poem. I haven't read it in a long time. This is my type of, like, if you're going to change it, this was really interesting to me. And for people that love the Odyssey or like care about it, I've told people, like, they're like, hey, have you seen the movie? I'm like, yeah. Like, what do you think? Do you think I'm going to like it? I'm like, do you care about the Odyssey? Like, do you care about this poem that was written thousands of years ago? And if they say no, I'm like, you're probably going to like it. If you say yes, there's a good chance that you might not. Like, that's just kind of the reality with adaptations these days. And so I don't mind the change. You mind the change,
yeah.
Which is fair and fine.
I 100% do. And I think that first and foremost, you know, my contention is that if you want to tell this story, do that somewhere else, because that's not this story. You know, to completely change the character of Odysseus, one is to insert 21st century worldviews and values onto a story that should be told from the perspectives of Greeks in the Bronze Age. And it's chronological snobbery to me to insert your own opinions about what this story should be in that way. Like, if you, again, that's why Oppenheimer works, because it tells the story that Nolan is very keen to want to tell, because that's Oppenheimer's existence. Mm-hmm. Like, that's what he feared, is that, yes, he had become the destroyer of worlds.
Yeah.
Right? Odysseus as a character in this story would never care about any of these things. The sacking of Troy to him is glorious. Everything he sees there is proof that the gods have given him victory. In fact, in the story, it's Athena herself who is the architect of this entire story. Mm-hmm. She's the one who gives him the idea for the Trojan horse and helps them complete it so that they can win the war finally. I mean, and so I think that's the problem about this, is that I think that Homer still has many things to say to us, because Odysseus's character is one who is full of hubris. Mm-hmm. He's a glory hog and proud, and it's his pride that gets him into so much trouble, because he tells the Cyclops at the end, Polyphemus, hey, it is Odysseus. He could have gotten away and been fine, but he pridefully exclaims, it's Odysseus who did this to you, the raider of cities that blinded you. And he's cursed, right? And then he ends up with Ceree and Cilia and Calypso for years because of his hubris.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And instead, Nolan wants to make this a movie about PTSD and regretting the sack of Troy, which he would never do. And it becomes this movie about trauma and trying to get over trauma. And, like, it's like, dude, the problem with it I also am bothered by is that Nolan is basically taking Christian morality that's so deeply embedded now into our Western world, mm-hmm. and overlaying that on a story that has no conception of Christian morality and ideology. And I don't think it works, because I think you do end up with this schism of ideologies that don't fit together. Like, you've placed on a character a Christian moral code with a pagan hero, and those don't combine very well. And we even see it in the story, because even at the end of the movie, right, Odysseus goes home and he kills all the suitors.
Yeah.
Well, if he's truly going to feel sorry for what he did, why is he killing all of them?
Yeah.
Like, again, there's this break in ideologies that are not consistent with one another. And so, therefore, the character comes off is completely inconsistent, which, dude, I guess if you want to show where we are in the world, where people are holding to all of these competing ideologies as if they can all be true, but they mm-hmm. can't, you're doing a great job. But I just don't appreciate a film. It's like the story has lasted for 3,000 years because it is still relevant today and it can still teach us things today. Are there going to be things in the story to which we wouldn't hold to? Yeah, but I mean, I just don't like Nolan's take, and I don't like that he's utilizing this to tell his own story and his, yeah, I just don't like it. And yeah. It doesn't work for me because that's not what the story is about.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't like what the story is about, go tell your own story. Don't overlay and skin suit a 3,000-year-old epic. That just drives me crazy. It's the same thing that I don't like about Dune mm-hmm. in a smaller scale, is that Villeneuve is also doing that with his tale of Dune.
Yeah.
It's like, if you don't like how Herbert wrote the story, go tell your own story. Don't change what he did because you think it's better or whatever. It's like, do the best version of that. It's obnoxious to me, and I hate when I hate it when they do that.
Mm.
It just drives me crazy.
Yeah.
And
I can tell. I think it make I again, this is the adaptation battle, right?
Sure.
In which,
well, and can I just say real quick, I totally appreciate that what you said earlier. It's like, there are some adaptations I love and there are some I hate, and I pick and choose, because I think in the end, in some ways, we all kind of do that to some extent.
Yeah. Like, I would criticize your love of Man of Steel because I don't think it's faithful. But like, that's a whole nother conversation and I'm making a joke. But like, that's the thing with adaptations. It's like, we just like ones we like. It either vibes with us or it doesn't. You either care deeply about the source material and you're like, if you don't get this right, heck off, man. Like, I do not care about your movie. Like, or you don't care. Like, Supergirl, we talked at length at Supergirl how much I hated that stupid movie because the source material is so good. Again, I don't have this deep connection to the Odyssey. The source material is good from what I mean, I read it over like 8 years ago. It's been a long time. But like, it's brilliant. I think there's a reason that it's lasted generations. The reason that the story has gone on so long. But Nolan changed it. He inserted some Christian morality, which you're like, I hate this. I'm like, I enjoy that. There's something missing, but I enjoy that somehow he's trying. But like, it's everyone's hypocrites. We're all hypocrites with our adaptations that we like. And I'm not saying this in a negative sense. I'm just using the word as like, we just like what we like. We pick what we like. And I think they are all valuable conversations. I think that the fact that this is maybe one of the first times we've disagreed on the show since I've started coming on, which is fun. It's nice that like, you don't like this movie as much. And I'm like, dude, this movie rocks. And it makes for a good conversation because we both came out of it with different feelings and different views on the adaptation itself and the changes that Nolan made. Are they beneficial or are they just him being, telling the same, the similar stories that he's been telling since Tenet. Like, you could view, I love the insight that someone's posted on social media, that you could review, ironically, Tenet, Oppenheimer, and The Odyssey as like this reverse trilogy, where it's like it starts with The Odyssey in ancient Greece, then you have Oppenheimer in the whatever year that was, I don't remember, 60s, 50s, something like that. 40s, World War II.
Yeah, the 40s.
I'm like, when was this? The 40s and World War II. And then you have whenever Tenet takes place, which is about similar things, about destruction, all this stuff. Like, no one's clearly talking about the same things. Do I think that if he talked about it again in another, his next movie, I'd be like, you're beating a giant Trojan horse there, dude. Like, we get it. I think he should do something different, which is a whole nother conversation. But yeah, I think I appreciate your view on it. I think that you're pointing out there's definitely inconsistencies with Odysseus's character, whether that's no one being intentional, and that's, you know, people that love the movie are like, it's intentional. Like, that's just how we view things, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But it's fun.
Well, and the other aspect of this that really bothered me is that there's this idea of like, to myth or not to myth, right? Because, you know, this is a story of classic Greek mythology. And, you know, one of the things that Nolan is very much known for is his deconstruction of things, right? Mm-hmm. Specifically superheroes. You know, he did it with Batman, and he kind of really started a trend towards that, right? Yep. And so I think we even talked about this before the movie came out, but one of my greatest fears is that Nolan would come in and deconstruct myth.
Mm-hmm.
And he did that.
He definitely did that.
Another thing that I absolutely hate about the film that it's his aversion to supernatural material.
It's not even that. It's his aversion to CGI. It's the only reason. It's got to be the only reason.
And see, that's not true, because you can do all of this without CGI.
Fair. He does a lot without CGI here, but
yeah, you it says that this is a time of apparent magic, and yet he strips out all the magic of the story because the Odyssey, again, Athena is the architect of the entire story. She gives Odysseus the idea for the Trojan horse.
Right.
She's the one who begs Zeus to free him from Calypso. Mm-hmm. She's the one who's moving his son and influencing him through Mentor and others.
Yeah, he's the one who's like, the beggar at the beginning of the movie. Yeah. It was usually in the story.
Barely in the film.
Yeah.
Like, I don't even know what she's doing in the film.
And you can make the argument, that she's not even Athena.
That all
it is you see at the very end at the sacking of Troy that Odysseus sees Zendaya, this just regular civilian girl, potentially being beheaded. You have the moment, which I love, of the beheading of the Athena statue in the middle of Troy. And then it's just him personifying his own trauma, his own grief, 100%.
Exactly.
This is Athena, and it's being projected as this girl. And so there's people that say there's no gods in this movie whatsoever.
Exactly.
I think you could argue that there is. I think you could argue that there isn't. Again, I don't care, but you care, and that matters. So, and I think this is more fair of a criticism for me than anything else we've talked about, where like, not anything else, but like, this is fair. The Odyssey is very, like, if you want to change the theming of it, if you want to change like some stuff here and there, but like, he did do some crazy stuff. He did do Circe and Polyphemus and Scylla, which I wish was done a little bit better. But yes, Zeus is not here. Poseidon's not here. Like, we're not getting those things happening, which I think is fair. If you're coming into an Odyssey epic, you're hoping that he does some of those things even further than what he did. And I think it's a fair criticism.
Well, and I think the other part about that is, right, is that, in all honesty, you're right. You can interpret this movie as having no gods, because everything he's telling you is from a drug-induced state, which you can read everything that he's telling Calypso as with a grain of salt, basically. You know, that, no, it's not really a Cyclops. It's not, you know... And I think that's the other part of this where it's, again, I love you, Chris Nolan, but if you don't want to utilize supernatural elements in your story, go tell another story.
Yeah.
Like, because that is this story.
Yeah.
I mean, it is full of gods and magic, and that's the worldview that they come from. This matters to them. They believe in this,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I think this is where I would argue that, I'm sorry, but Christopher Nolan was the worst person to make this film because he doesn't appreciate a different worldview than his own.
Yeah.
He's not willing to suspend his own ideology to try and bring to life a story that, quote unquote, doesn't make sense to him. I mean, he puts the Trojan horse in the sand because he can't understand how people will, in a story from 3,000 years ago, would bring a horse on wheels into their city. Bro, come on, man. Like, it's like, and that's the thing that just really frustrates me, is because it's like a lack of imagination to me. Like, where is your imagination?
Yeah.
That is part of storytelling. And again, I think he's so in tune with his own materialist understanding of the world that he can't even conceive of a world where people would accept gods and goddesses as reality. And it's frustrating to me. And
yeah.
I think it really does hurt. Again, this is like when you think about what the Odyssey is, which is the cornerstone of Western civilization, and the other cornerstone becomes Christianity and the Bible.
Yeah.
It's like you have these two things, and he doesn't like either of them. And so
people keep saying he should do the Bible next. And I'm like, only if he has a pastor that is with him, you know?
Come to Jesus and then do it. I do have to say, though, and I wanted to talk to you about this because this is something that Nolan is incredibly good at. Mm-hmm. And I think this movie does put that on display, which is just scope, right? The scope of this film is in the vein of, you know, Ben-Hur and the Ten Commandments, in the sense of grandeur and scale that we're going to put people out on a Viking boat. I don't know why it's a Viking boat, but regardless, you know, we're going to put people out on the ocean. You know, we're going to put people in these real locations feel very real. So what did you think about just that aspect of the film?
Yeah, I think it's incredible. I think if there's anything that's like no one can really touch, like no, there can be no real argument for his movies, is his technical abilities here. Like, the movie looks amazing. You have cinematographer Hoyt Van Hoytema, who's awesome. There's all the practical stuff. Like, the movie feels massive. It's meant for a massive screen. You know, like, it just, you do feel very immersed in whatever he's telling. Whether you feel immersed emotionally, that's a different story. But you can feel immersed, like, just, like, by the, just how big it is. It's like you said, it's like Ben-Hur, it's like Sam Hamm, it's like Lawrence of Arabia. Like, it's an epic with all these different elements. And I think it's obviously what he does best. Like, he wants to go big. That's why he loves IMAX so much. That's why he's creating technology for just, you know, IMAX cameras and, you know, all this stuff. So I love it. Obviously, I think that he's done it before. He's done it with like Interstellar, which feels massive. Even his smaller movies feel big. Like, Oppenheimer feels massive, even though they're talking the whole movie. But this does work to his sensibilities a lot more, where he wants to make these big giant set pieces and big practical effects and do all this stuff. And he gets to do that here, and it proves why he's so good at what he does from a technical perspective.
Yeah, I think discussing all of that with the scope and the scale as we're talking about, but also mm-hmm. just even the as you're mentioning, it's like the practical elements that we're utilizing with the Cyclops mm-hmm. and the stunt performers that are 7 feet tall, and the way they do the whirlpool, all of this stuff is, I think, really well done. Mm-hmm. And you know, I there are definitely some quibbles I kind of have in certain places, because I feel like there's some, I would say there's some serious anachronisms in the film, in the sense of like what things look like. I don't understand why the Leia Strigonians look like they come from medieval Europe. Yeah. I don't necessarily get why, you know, we get to see Pattinson's pasty white thighs, but, you know, every time we see Timelicus, he's in pants, which don't exist then. There's just a lot of places where, like, yeah. I really appreciate and I like, but there's other places where I was a little bit frustrated. And but in the end, the scope and the scale of this, I think, is really incredible, actually. Yeah. And yeah. I think, you know, again, there truly are very few people who make films like this. And
that's true.
And it's you know, I think one of the reasons that people are really responding to this is because we want to see something we've never seen before.
Yeah.
Right? And, you know, and you brought up earlier, I really appreciate you did, you know, our conversation about Supergirl. And one of the things we're so frustrated with in that story is just like how much of it didn't feel interesting or special, or like we hadn't seen it all before a million times. And no one's good at giving you that. And I really appreciate that he's good at giving us that. And regardless of whether I love the movie or anything, man, just being immersed in it, like, you know, only he and I think Villeneuve at this point are truly good at immersing you in something you feel like you've never seen before.
Yeah.
Which is impressive. And so what did you think of the cast? And I don't look, whatever to the casting frustrations people had, but I mean, like, you know, when I think of like the main characters in the movie who really matter, you've got, you know, Matt Damon, Tom Holland, Anne Hathaway, Robert Pattinson, and John Leguizamo are all the roles that kind of truly matter for the film and the and what it means for like performance wise. And so how did you think everybody did?
It's gonna come as no surprise, but I think everyone is very good. I think even supporting characters, I think Samantha Morton as Cersei was really, really good, in particular, like that scene. But I think Matt Damon is awesome. Like, it's, I don't, I wouldn't say it's his best performance ever, but like, I think it's like a career defining performance. He's having to do a lot. The whole movie's on his shoulders. Like, we're getting great supporting performances, as we'll see. But like, I think he's just like, so like him with the sirens, like where he's like screaming and he's got the voiceover over that. Like, that is, I'm like, that's like, Matt Damon is such a good actor. I love Matt Damon. I think Tom Holland's, he's fantastic as Spider-Man, obviously, which hopefully we're going to see again in like a week. Oh my goodness, I'm so excited for that. But I think he's really good. I don't think he's amazing. It's hard to like stand out when your scene partners are Matt Damon, Anne Hathaway, and Robert Pattinson, who are, Hathaway and Damon are arguably some of the best of their generation in their respective areas. And then Robert Pattinson's arguably one of the best just working actors today, just I think he's so good. His ability to play this like scared loser, but has this like acts like he's this guy that's in charge. Like the thing that's going viral right now is like, can you please get like these beggars out of here? And like his inflection and what he's saying. And I think his performance when he's like, there's the fight that's happening when Odysseus is fighting everybody. And he's like hiding behind the pole. He's like, get the spears, get the swords. Like, I think that's so funny. And he's so good. I think Anne Hathaway is awesome as well. And I mean, this, everybody that we have listed here, I think there's other people that are giving good performances, like, as I said, but like this, like five people, I think are so good. I think the movie works because of them. I think even if you don't love changes, I think we're seeing really great performances from them. Like the Tom Holland, the one I think of the moment that I think of, like, where I'm like, wow, this guy can act, like he can really prove it, is when he is with Odysseus and Odysseus goes up to Argus, his dog. And when he realizes that it's his dad, like there's this like moment, there's like this sparkle in his eye that happens. And I'm like, man, you're a good actor. So I love this cast. I love these five in particular. I think they're really good. I think they play their roles for what they're given well. So, and I'm a fan of the movie. So like, I'm not going to, it's not shocking that I love these. I'm curious what you think, as you're not as into the adaptation, but like, what do you think of, you know, these guys and how they're performing?
Yeah, I mean, I think everybody did really well. I think you kind of called out Tom Holland. I think he actually did a really good job. And, you know, it was funny because he said that he was in an interview talking about Robert Pattinson, and he basically was like, yeah, I knew that it was going to be great working with Rob because he's such a D word. He can be such a D. And yeah, I was like, yeah, oh man, that's hilarious, because that's my awesome. Wife and I basically said the exact same thing about his performance. Like, he's just so good at that.
He's the worst guy. Yeah.
He just is the worst. And the worst. So yeah, I love it. I think everybody was really good, but the performance to me that stands out the most was actually John Leguizamo.
Yeah, I think it's totally fair.
He is so good in this movie, and yeah, I would say he's actually the best actor in the film.
I think that's not crazy.
Makes you believe everything about this character,
yeah,
and I love him in the film.
Mm-hmm.
I think he brings to life the story better than anybody else in the movie, which is kind of weird. I just think he's phenomenal. I was really blown away by his performance. And so, yeah, you know, I don't, there's nobody here is bad. And so, you know, did certain people get nothing to do in the movie? Like, I can't believe that Zendaya is in the movie because she does nothing. You know,
I think
like,
she's
there's
good
a lot
at what
of,
she does, but yeah, she's not in a whole lot.
I don't know if she's good. I think she just is. And so, like, because I don't think, again, to me, she does nothing in the movie. She basically sits there and like looks at people, and
right,
it's like, okay, great. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I got to ask you about this.
Yep.
The score.
Yeah.
Ludwig Göransson comes in for this score. And of course, because it's Nolan and Göransson, we're going to use gongs and panpipes. But we're still going to use synthesizers.
Of course. Yeah.
So how does this work for you?
Again, I'm so biased. Like, it's not even like a fair conversation. I love the score. It's very different. It was not what I was expecting. I think a lot of it's very subdued. It doesn't feel as big. And in certain moments, it feels gigantic because, like, the movie was loud. I think it's very subdued compared to like Oppenheimer, compared to like an Interstellar, some of the bigger scores that Nolan's had in his movies. I do really like it. I think it works well with the movie. I think I love the like the plucking and the stringing to when Odysseus like does the bow thing at the end and in the movie, where like he it's like building and then he plucks the bow and then it ascends. Like, I love that. I think Ludwig is very, very, very good at what he does. I understand if people are like, yeah, this isn't my favorite. Like, it just didn't feel as big or as grand for a Nolan movie, especially of this scale. Like, I think that's a fair criticism. I really enjoyed it. I've been listening to it a lot. It's very listenable. So I think it's fun watching some behind the scenes stuff of what Ludwig was trying to do and, you know, using instruments that have not been used in ages, probably. So I think it's cool. I think it's fun. It's not as big as I thought it was going to be, but I did like it.
Yeah, that is really interesting because I hate it.
Oh, wow.
I really absolutely hate it.
Why?
I think it's terrible.
I think it's interesting.
It's discordant, and it was so loud in the movie, and it didn't help. And to me, what it did was it just ratcheted up this nihilistic feeling that I had towards the movie the whole time. And I miss the understanding that thematic music can make or break a film. I miss that thematic music, that orchestral music can really bring to life a movie. And to me, this just, it grated on me the entire film, and it drove me insane. Like, I just, and I, you know me, like, I love movie scores, right? Yeah, like, I just, totally. Scores are my thing. Like, and I listened to this too. I was listening to it, and it just was not enjoyable. Like, there was nothing about it that was enjoyable to listen to. Mm-hmm. When I was just listening to it on its own, and I just responded really badly to it. And I think that I would have enjoyed more actually Nolan going sans Nolan, like by doing something in the vein of more like a Horner or Williams or something along that, those lines, to where it made, I don't know, there's something about this just doesn't work for me at all. It just really bothered me, and it made to me the movie even more unpleasant to experience. And when a score does that, and when a sound design does that, it drove me crazy. I also have to say, Christopher Nolan, please stop with your stupid sound mixing. Because fair. I need to be able to hear dialogue. Like, movie is a visual and auditory medium, and if I can't, I get what you're going for, which is which is the realism, right? I get what you're going for, but we're not here for realism. we're here for a story, and that just drove me crazy. So
I mean I didn't feel that way about the score. I think I feel that way a little bit sometimes about the sound mixing. I'm like, dude, this is loud. Like in IMAX, I was like,
yes,
holy moly, man. Like, I feel
so
like
so loud,
my eardrums were like hurting a little bit. I changed where I sat the second time I saw it in IMAX. So I was like, dude, I cannot do this again. I think it's fair. I think I've heard a lot of people not connecting with this score as much. I've enjoyed it. I'm going to continue to listen to it. Maybe my opinion will change. I don't know. There's certain songs that I like a lot, and certain that aren't really standouts versus like an Oppenheimer. I thought the score was like magnificent, or Interstellar. I'm like, this whole track, like every track's amazing. So I think things like that. It's not the highlight of the movie by any means, but I think I like it still.
Yeah. I did want to talk about one thing too. Obviously, the movie is filmed in IMAX, right? With the IMAX cameras, you know, that's a big part of the film.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask you about, just have a conversation a little bit about theaters. And why in the world are we not building more places for people to actually see things in the true IMAX format?
Yeah.
You know, I don't understand what's going on, because obviously shows for this in the, what are there only 40-something theaters 41. In the world that can show this on in the 70mm IMAX, which seems to be insane to me.
So I
wonder how you feel about that in the sense that, like, neither of us got to see it in its true format.
Yeah,
because it just doesn't exist.
I'm hoping that this movie stays in theaters for quite some time, because I'm going to be in California in a couple weeks and in September as well. So I'm hoping that like they just keep it running in IMAX 70 millimeter, because I'll definitely go then. It's hard. I wish I could see. I mean, I thought about driving to Canada. I thought about flying to LA. I thought about these things like legitimately, because of a movie this scale, yeah. You want to see it on what it was, that what the director, who's one of my favorite directors, intended to show it on, you know?
Right.
I clearly don't think it inhibits the movie in a way where I can't enjoy it a lot still. I clearly still liked it. From what I understand, it's really expensive to build the projectors, really expensive to build the screens apparently. And like, is it worth the money for, let's say, even 5 movies a year? Maybe, maybe not. I think that's what they're probably wrestling with. That's what I keep seeing people ask the CEO of IMAX, like, why the heck are you not doing this? I think IMAX is up for sale right now, which is a problem if a movie studio bought it, obviously. But I think whoever buys it should, at least in major cities, it's not going to be everywhere, but like, I think they should have more in New York and LA. I think that there should be one in Portland. There should be one in Seattle. There should be one in, where would be another, like Chicago, if there's not one, I don't know, like big cities where there's big cultures of movies. Like, I get if you don't want to put it in Tulsa, like, yeah, probably not the biggest investment. Obviously, I would like that. In a perfect world, there should be an IMAX, 70 millimeter IMAX in every single theater. But it does require projectionists and like jobs, which is a good thing. But
I would argue too, like, by doing this, you are doing something that people literally can't get in their home, right? No matter how good your setup is home, you can't do this,
no.
Right? And so, yeah, I mean, I don't want a major studio to buy the IMAX format, but I would love to see one of the theater chains do it. I mean, you know, you've got AMC that works with Dolby Cinema, and they do such a great job with their presentation. And so it's like, man, just I'm a AMC guy because that's what I've got here with their A-list. So buy IMAX so that you also are making more money in that format, and so every one of your theaters you want to have an IMAX in because you're making more money. To me, that makes sense.
It's a huge money grab now. Yeah,
exactly. The premium format, you know, every theater is looking for the premium format because that's where they make more money, especially like because AMC owns Dolby Cinema.
Yeah,
they make more money on those tickets, whereas if they have an IMAX, they don't.
Right.
Because IMAX is not owned by them, and therefore they're shelling out money to the whoever owns IMAX, you know, at that point. So it's like,
totally.
It makes sense for them to just then own. Anyway.
Yeah, formats have become a very big contentious thing, obviously. I mean, we're seeing, like, if you don't know this already and you're listening to this and you're like, what's Infinity Vision? It's not a new format. They're lying to you.
Yeah,
it's
nothing.
Just a stamp of approval. It's stupid. Okay. There's my rant.
It's because they can't get
IMAX.
Yeah, because Dune has all the IMAX formats.
So it's an interesting conversation.
Yeah. Well, before we get to our let's do this. Let's do our ratings first, and then we'll rank Nolan, because this is going to play into, I think, we don't want to give away what our rating for the film is. So
totally.
I want to know what your rating is. The Odyssey.
Yeah. It's Nolan. It's right up my alley. I very much like it, as we can tell. I gave it a 5 out of 5. After I gave it on first viewing, it stayed in the subsequent 2 viewings after that. So I'm at a 5 out of 5.
Well, this was an interesting thing, because I was actually supposed to see this Monday again.
Mm. Yeah.
I didn't go.
Yeah.
And so I didn't want to. I just didn't. I am going to be generous.
Totally.
And I'm going to give this movie 3.25 out of 5.
Okay.
You can't do 0.25 on Letterboxd, so it's a 3.5.
Yeah.
But I think there's a lot of things in this movie that are really good.
Mm-hmm.
But I think this is actually one of the least Nolan films. It's just, I mean, he had this amazing run, and you hit the Odyssey, and it's just, it's a major road bump for me. It's just, yeah, it doesn't work for me the way he wants it to. And, totally. So where are you then with your rankings of Christopher Nolan?
Yeah. Do you want me to go through all of them?
Yeah. I would start at the bottom and we'll build our way to what our number one is.
All right. I've seen every single Christopher Nolan movie. The only one I hadn't watched recently was Insomnia, and so I visited for the first time. So at 13, I have his debut Following. It's not a bad movie. I like the movie. I give it 3 stars, but it's very much like a student film, is what it is. My number 12, from this point on, everything is a 4-star or higher. So these are good movies. I just want to let everybody know that. My number 12 is The Dark Knight Rises. Really like the movie. Think it's great. I think there's some of the best Nolan scenes ever are in these movies. Like the opening, I love the opening of this movie so much. I watched it this morning because I was like, I got to rewatch this. 11 is Insomnia. Cool movie. Very interesting to see Nolan do kind of subdued, smaller scale. Would be really interesting to see him do it again, but I don't know if he's ever going to do that. Number 10 is Batman Begins. I think it's a great origin story. I think it's a great movie. I love it. I think it's got some issues. It's got some things that I'm not the biggest fan of, but I do really enjoy Batman Begins. Number 9 is Memento. Really like it. I've stayed pretty much the same on it since I rewatched it the last couple of weeks. Like, it's really good. It's really solid, but again, not my favorite thing in the world. Number 8, this is one of my hotter takes with Nolan's ranking, is Inception. I love Inception. I think it's great, but I am not on the train that everybody is on, where it's his best. I like it a lot. Number 7 is Tenet, despite its audio issues and like the sound mixing. It's not the best, but I you know, no one said it, and it's pretentious as heck, but you know, you just got to feel it, and I feel it when I watch Tenet. I love that movie. Number six and on. We're talking, these are all 5 stars. I love Nolan. This is no secret. I love this guy. The Dark Knight, amazing. It's really low for a lot of people, but I mean, this is like a perfect superhero movie. It's incredible. The Joker's and like Heath Ledger's incredible. It's got issues, but I love it. I grew up with it. Number 5, The Prestige. I love this movie a lot. Fell in love with it a few years ago when the first time I watched it, before Oppenheimer. Really, really enjoyed it. I love the performances. I love the twist. I think it's one of the better ones in cinema history. Number 4, I have Dunkirk. This is a recent thing where I had this at like my 8 or 9, and I rewatched it, and I was blown away somehow on my TV at home, as Nolan did not intend. Number 3 is Oppenheimer. I love it. Like, this is incredible, making a blockbuster talking for 3 hours. It's crazy. Number 2 is The Odyssey. I fell in love with it. I am seeing it again on Sunday and again in a week with my wife on Saturday the 1st. And then number 1 is Interstellar. It will always probably forever be. He would have to make something so good for it not to be Interstellar. I think it's you talk about hope. There's a lot of hope. There's a lot of heart. It's his most heartfelt movie he's ever made. And I think I do love The Odyssey. I do love Oppenheimer. Clearly, I would love another movie like Interstellar. Interstellar is just so special to me. But
man, that's great. The only film of his that I haven't seen is The Following. And, okay, you know, the main reason is that I kind of heard exactly what you said from a lot of people, which is that it's a student film, and I just didn't feel like watching it, you know, honestly. So that's not on my list. So at number 12, it's Insomnia. It's not a bad movie, but it's also not a great movie. I think it's a good, it's just a movie that's decent. Yep. It's above average, but just barely.
Yeah.
Next for me is The Odyssey. Which, you know, it's a super lower tier Nolan, and I might never watch it again. So
I'll watch it for you. Don't worry.
Yeah. At number 10 is Memento. I remember seeing this movie in college and it just kind of blowing me away. Mm. And I think, you know, it's the first movie, of course, where no one's just truly playing with time. Mm-hmm. And it's where his obsession with time, I think, really comes from. And so I think it's great. But, you know, there are more on the list. So number 9, Batman Begins.
Okay.
This is a great movie. I really love Batman Begins, and it's such a good introduction to his understanding of the world. And I think one of the beauties is that it's the Batman movie that he did, I think, that gets Gotham right the most. Mm. I love his Gotham in this movie, and it's just a great movie. So number 8, from this point on, every film is 5 stars. So it was just like, hey, where am I putting a 5-star film?
Yeah.
Is Tenet.
Yeah.
I'm with you. I remember seeing this movie for the first time, and it just clicked with me.
Yeah.
Like, and I don't have an issue with, like, I know people, what's happening in the movie? I don't understand it. And all, it's like, I don't know. Man, I watched over 700 hours of Star Trek, so I get temporal mechanics, and it doesn't bother me. I just think it's one of the most audacious and kind of like out there crazy films that he's ever done. And it works for me. Number 7, Dunkirk. Man, I actually want to rewatch this movie, but the way he plays with time in this is so brilliant. And I just think it's a really beautiful movie. It's really well done. Number 6, my wife and I just rewatched this, Inception. Inception is still fantastic. And again, talk about making a movie that truly has imagination. I mean, Inception, it's full of it. Number 5, The Prestige. This movie's so good. And the performances in it are so good. I love it. It's truly like it deserves to be at number 5. The Dark Knight is number 4. It's wonderful. I love The Dark Knight. It's fantastic. But number 3 is The Dark Knight Rises, because for me, man, I love what Nolan does with the end of this story, that he has the cojones to end Batman as a story, to tell a complete arc for the character. I love the moment when Batman, who has been a character that's always in the shadows and in the dark, is in broad daylight fighting on the steps of City Hall with Bane. And it's like he's fully come out of the dark. And by doing so, he has, you know, inspired an entire city to be behind him. It's great. Number 2, Oppenheimer. I think it is just a masterpiece on every single level. And like you said, it's a film where people are talking for 4 hours. Not really 4 hours, but it never feels long. And I appreciate what he is wanting to say in that film. I think it's where that thematic element fits and works perfectly. And like you said, number 1 is, I don't ever see him doing a film better than Interstellar. And I think it's because it is the story that has the most heart. And Nolan does have a reputation of being somebody who can be cold. And this is the movie that's anything but cold. You know, they say space is cold, but apparently it's not, because it has the most warmth of any movie he's ever made. It's beautiful. Mm-hmm. I love it. So, yeah, that's my ranking for Christopher Nolan. And, man, like you said, I can't wait till next week, because I'll be honest, this might be the most disappointing film of the year for me so far.
Yeah, I know. Sorry.
But Spider-Man's next week, and I'm really hoping that that's good, because I need some hope for Marvel, because I saw the Doomsday trailer, and goodness, I have thoughts.
Anyway,
if people wanted to catch up with you and you know, talk about movies and see what else is going on in life, where would they find you?
Yeah, over on Instagram at Rye Talks Movies, as well as Letterboxd, Rye Talks Movies as well. Those are the two main places that I'll be posting. I might start posting some reviews and stuff on YouTube. It'd be the same thing, Rye Talks Movies on YouTube. So, and if you hear a baby, that's my 7-month-old.
You know what? That's totally okay. Babies are welcome on the show. You could find me all over the place under MattRushing02 on Instagram and Letterboxd and X Twitter, all those places. You can also find me here on the network outside the 602 Club with a lot of great Star Trek talk with Chris Jones. And of course, Strange New Worlds is coming back, so we'll be back and Saddle Up. You can also find me over on the Nerd Party Network with a couple of shows. One is Outposts, about every single chapter of the Harry Potter series, and Aggressive Negotiations with John Mills as we talk about Star Wars each and every week. But thank you so much for joining us.
And y'all come back now, you hear?